Okay, let's make a start. Good morning to everybody. For those who remember my announcement last week, I wasn't meant to be here today. So like all plans that we make for travel, everything is now fluid. So the next time I say that I'm not planning to be here, then don't believe me, because it might not happen. Next week, please God, I am planning to be here, Be'ezrat Hashem. But the 2 weeks after that, I'm planning to be in America. But you know something? Don't bank on anything. So be in touch with me and I'll tell you if I'm really going to be here or not. But certainly welcome to everyone who's here, and welcome to everyone on Zoom. Definitely appreciate you being with us on Zoom, and if you can be with us live, that's even better, but Zoom is also great. I'd like to thank our sponsors for the year 2021. The year has been sponsored anonymously in the merit of Aneliyah for the Neshamas of Masasiyahu Ben Yisrael, Aaron Ben Menachem Lev, and Eliana Bas Yaakov. Thank you for that sponsorship. And we are staying with the theme that we started last week, just for today. Next week, I've got some ideas for something else, something new, but it depends on a lot of things between now and then. But this year, we're going to come to the medical. Last week, we looked at cosmetic surgery. This week, we're going to look at, a more interesting medical ethical issue, which is surrogacy. Surrogacy, as I'm sure people are aware, is a relatively new technology. It's been around about 30 or 40 years, about 30 years probably now, whereby there are people with infertility challenges who are able to have a baby only through a surrogate. We'll talk a little bit about that in a minute. And there are questions, many questions that come up. Specifically and particularly, of course, since you're using another mother in order to carry and give birth to this baby, who is the halakhic mother? That is the whodunit, if you like, question as to what's going to be the focus for the shir. So one of the underlying hashkafic, maybe meta-halakhic questions is not just who is the halakhic mother, but where do we look to answer a question like this? I'm more interested in some ways in that question, because that goes to the underlying issue of halakhic process, which is, you know, those of you who've been to my shir, I like that question and I find that question interesting. So we'll see towards the end of the shir some ideas from Rav Bick, Rav Ezra Bick, and other people as well. So the first two sources I put on the shir were the sources from last week. I'm not proposing to go through them again, but they are. I wanted to put them again on this sheet because they're very apposite to this question, which is the idea, if you remember, these first two sources we looked at last week, that Judaism is in principle interventionist on these issues. We're not worried about playing God in the sense that there's a limit to what we should do. Our limits are halachic. Once something is no longer halachically permitted, we can't do it. But if it is halachically permitted, and it can help people to have children, to build the world, etc., our default position is that it's acceptable. There is a tshuva, which I didn't bring you on the sheet, from Rav Moshe Feinstein many years ago when he was asked on the issue of artificial insemination by donor, where a couple are unable to have a baby because of an issue with the sperm, and they're able to get a donor sperm to fertilize the mother's egg and create a child. And they asked Rav Moshe Feinstein whether this was acceptable. And he had a long tshuva, and he says, obviously this is not the way that we plan to build a Jewish family, but this couple were not in an ideal position, and this was the choice that they had. And at the end of the day, he says, there is nothing halakhically prohibited about this, it is permitted, obviously it's a very bidyevet situation. And other people went wild, how can you say this? And Rav Yaakov Breisch, who we did see last week on another tshuva, in Switzerland, wrote to him and said, even the Catholics don't allow this. And he came out with this very strongly worded essay, and he said, I believe in Torah and only Torah, we're based on Torah, and Torah is what guides us. And out of context, you think that he's talking to, I don't know, the Reform rabbinic establishment. No, he's talking to a Hasidic Apostolic in Zurich, saying, this is mutter and this woman needs it, why are you telling me that even the Catholics don't do that? Why do I care what the Catholics do? I base it on halacha and halacha alone, and once it is acceptable, if it's needed, then it's acceptable. And therefore, the first source, if you remember, was Rabbi Akiva and Ternus Rufus, where Ternus Rufus says, why do you intervene? Why do you make poor people rich? Why do you make sick people better? Surely God will do what he wants with these people. And he says, no, we are meant to be the ones that intervene to help the sick to be better and help the poor to be settled. And the second source in number 2 from Bereishis Rabbah, where the philosopher asks Rabbi Hoshaya, if God wanted a bris milah, why aren't people born with a bris milah? Isn't the man born with a bris milah? And he says, no, everything needs tikkun. We are there to be mataken, and God leaves room for us to do tikkun. So in that sense, maybe we will have issues with surrogacy, we'll see, but we should default to and start from a position whereby if it's not osa, then it's mutter. And we'll see what that where that takes. So at the bottom of page one, I'm not going to go through this. There are many different kinds of fertility treatment which are available now, which is an enormous bracha for people who are trying to start a family. And some of them are fairly low intervention, like hormonal treatments and different kinds of IVF. We'll talk a bit more about IVF later. Surrogacy, as I said, is where usually the way it works is as follows. They take the husband, they take the father's sperm, they take the mother's ovum, they take multiples and they fertilize them in vitro, which people used to call back in the day test tube babies, but they don't do anything using a test tube as far as I'm aware. They use a petri dish or something like that. And then they will implant the fertilized ovum. Normally in IVF, they implant that back in the mother. So that enables the fertilization to take place and the mother can carry the baby. And there are millions and millions and millions of IVF test tube babies who now walk the streets. Because they've been doing this since the 1970s, I believe. But in surrogacy, of course, they can't implant it in the mother, the donor of the egg, because she can't carry a baby. Usually there is a medical issue with the uterus that she can't carry a baby to full term or she can't give birth. And therefore, they implant it within a surrogate mother. The question is, of course, who are you going to choose? You're going to choose a non-Jewish woman, you're going to choose a Jewish woman, and we'll see why that choice becomes very important. But that is one of the classic questions which we'll see on fertilization, on which the poskim have a lot to say. Interestingly, we are now in a position, medically, where we can perform ovary transplants, uterus transplants, and therefore you can have a woman who has a donated organ, an ovary, which is donated from another woman, which is then inside her body, and she can conceive and give birth to a child, even though the genetics, the genetic makeup of that child is from the donor mother, from the donor organ. But there the poskim are pretty much all clear that the mother is the woman who conceived it, and the mother who carried it and gave birth to it, because the fact that the ovary came technically from another woman is now no longer relevant. That ovary is part of her body. And actually, interestingly, one of the earliest tshuvas on this, in the late 1800s, there was a doctor who announced, almost certainly incorrectly and falsely, it was a fraud probably, that he'd successfully performed an ovary ovarian transplant on a woman, it's 120 years ago, who then conceived and given birth normally. And even though no one believed this doctor, the rabbinic establishment picked up on this and said, so if we could indeed do that, what would the halachic situation be? And I brought you in the footnote a very old tshuva on this by Rabbi Kusiel Aryeh Kamelha, I'd never really heard of him in Poland, who said that in an ovary transplant situation, then the mother is definitely the woman who has the ovary inside her, not the donor. Whether that act works for surrogacy or not is a good question, because surrogacy is a little bit different, because you've got an egg from another mother and with fertilized by a sperm from another man put into not a random woman but a complete third party. So we'll see if this still works. Now let's have a look over the page. Go to page two. I've raised here some ethical issues involved in fertility treatment. I'm not going to go through them. Obviously, there's a lot to talk about. Rav Yuval Shurlo actually got involved in a discussion on the ethics of surrogacy, and people may be aware that in the Far East there's a lot of abuse of women who are effectively enslaved to act as surrogates to have babies for other people. So there's an entire ethical angle to this, which I'm not speaking about today, but that doesn't mean it's not important. And I gave you a reference in the footnotes to Rav Shurlo's perspective on that from a halachic and hashkafic Jewish standpoint. But there are many ethical issues, but I'm focusing on the halachic issues. So let's look at a couple of these. Number one, the key question is, what is the familial connection between the surrogate mother, the genetic mother, etc., and the baby? This is relevant for many things. We need to know who your mummy is for inheritance, for kibud av va'em, for consanguinity. We need to know who you can marry or not. Can a child of a surrogate mother marry another child of that same surrogate mother, but completely genetically unrelated? Let's say this surrogate mother acts as a surrogate mother for eight families and has eight children, all of whom are genetically completely unrelated to each other. but they're all born from the same woman. Are they related or are they not related? These are obviously very important questions. Kahuna issues. If a Kohen fertilizes an egg which is then implanted in a non-Jewish woman, does that affect the status of the baby? Can that baby ever be a Kohen or not be a Kohen? That's a very important question as well. Mamzerut, what if we take an egg fertilized by another man's sperm and implant that in a married woman? Is that in some case, in some way, a problem? She's now carrying a child of another man, but that was implanted in her as a surrogate. Is that a problem or is that not a problem? Does one fulfill the mitzvahs of puravu without any sexual connection? That's obviously an issue for IVF. You know, if someone makes an IVF baby, is that puravu? Is that a satisfaction of that mitzvah? There are many other issues here as well, which we're not going to deal with most of them, but we're really focusing on the question of who is the mother. There isn't really a question who is the father in the classic surrogacy setup, because there's sperm only from one man, so there's no one else that really qualifies as who could be the father. But you have an egg from a genetic mother, you have a womb of a surrogate mother. There are even more complex cases where you have another woman involved as a mitochondrial donor. There are some women that have a problem with the mitochondria, which is passed down from the mother. They have a fault in the mitochondria. So what they'll do is they'll take a healthy egg with healthy... Mitochondria are like the power packs of the cell, and they have their own DNA and their own internal structure, and they live little organelles within the cell. So if a woman has a mitochondrial defect, they will take a healthy egg with healthy mitochondria, remove the genetic material from that egg, from whom it came, the mother that it came from, insert the nucleus of the egg of the woman that we're trying to make the genetic child of, and then implant that into either the woman or a surrogate mother. So you could have three women potentially. One is the genetic provider, one is the mitochondrial provider, and one is the womb environment birth provider. So then there's three mothers, and then you've got a father as well. So, you know, you've got four parents there to work out. These are obviously interesting questions which we're going to look at. Now, in the early days of surrogacy, the halachic assumption was, okay, so, you know, the birth mother, well, also the medical assumption was, that the birth mother just acts as an incubator. You know, everything comes from other people. You take an egg from another woman, a sperm from a man, you fertilize them in vitro, you implant them into this woman. She's basically just renting out her womb. It's like rent a womb for 9 months, and then she'll give them away, and therefore she has very little to say in terms of her contribution to the babies. The babies are the genetic children of the genetic donors, not her. But over time and recently, and when I last gave this shiur in the OU, it was like 5-6 years ago, and a lot has moved on medically since then. There's now a lot of research in the epigenetic field, where we now realize more and more that just because a child has a certain genetic makeup, there's a lot of genes inside the nucleus and the chromosomes of a cell, many of them are not turned on. There are a lot of genes that could potentially be switched on or left switched off. What switches them on and off can be very environmental. What kind of proteins are released, what kind of environment they're in. So even though you have the genes from a completely different woman implanted in a surrogate, the surrogate, the placenta, actually is quite permeable, and there's a lot of stuff flowing across the placenta from the mother to the fetus, from the fetus to the mother. In fact, now we know that there are fetal stem cells which are embedded in the body of the mother that carried that baby for life. In fact, they're doing some interesting Alzheimer's research as to whether it makes a difference whether you have female or male fetal stem cells inside your body. I don't have any fetal stem cells at all inside my body, so it's not going to make any difference to me, because, you know, I've never been pregnant, not yet anyway. But women definitely who have been pregnant have that, and so also with the child. The child carries stem cells from the mother who carried it. So it could well be that even though you say, well, this one was just an incubator, no, it's the chemical environment that this woman's placenta is providing which can impact on which genes turn on and which genes don't turn on. Now, I'm sure I've massively oversimplified it, and if anyone's watching that knows anything about genes, they'll probably have their hand over their eyes saying, what a hash he's made of all of that. Okay, I've done the best I can. I'm a rabbi and a lawyer. I'm not a medical expert. But it does make it much more interesting to ask whether the surrogate mother has more impact halachically into the baby in terms of motherhood as well. So she's not just an incubator. There's more going on. Okay, all of that is by way of introduction. Let's go on to page number 3. We're now going to examine lots and lots of sources. It's going to be a bit of a roller coaster, but hopefully you will enjoy it, and we will move forward with these sources. It'll give you some cause to think about. Many years ago in London, there was quite a celebrated case of surrogacy. Many years ago now, people who lived in London 20, 30 years ago remember it, where there was a family with early days of surrogacy. Where for whatever reason there were a medical issue, she was unable to carry a child in her own womb, and they did a surrogate arrangement with a non-Jewish woman. This was a prominent family in London back in the 90s. They did a surrogate arrangement with a non-Jewish woman who carried triplets, two identical twins and a sibling, three little boys, which she then gave birth to and gave back to the parents. And she's very connected to the family. She's like an aunt. I know the family. She was at the Bris. She was at the Bar Mitzvah. They're not married yet. But there were a lot of interesting shilas. And Lord Jacobowitz, of course, who was very connected with all of these issues. I think at the time he was no longer the chief rabbi. But of course, he, as we said last week, the founding father of Jewish medical ethics. He was very much involved in this. You'll remember this case very well. You were at the Bris. I was also at the Bris. So the Britot. Yes. So they had a lot of discussion about this in London, and we'll talk about what Rav Jacobowitz decided. An interesting extra factor is in this particular case, the father is a Cohen. And there was another question as to how that impacts on the babies. All of this will come through the discussion that we're going to have. Okay, let's have a look at page number 3. Source number 3. How important is genetics in halacha when discussing parenthood? And the answer is relevant, but not always decisive. For example, number 3, Rabbi Yossi Omer, Ger Shenidgar Kekoton Shenolad Dami. Famous principle, a ger that converts is like a newborn child. You are no longer halachically the child of the parents that came until that conversion. So let's take Christine. Christine has two nice non-Jewish parents, whatever you call them, George and Jessica. And Christine grows up and decides to become Jewish. Christine is no longer the child of her non-Jewish prior parents. Now, it doesn't mean she can't be connected with them, and she doesn't mean she can't go to there for dinner. Of course, they've got to make her kosher food and bishul akum, and they've got to deal with all the halachic issues. But she's not their halachic child. Even though she's the genetic child. Where, by the way, do we get this idea from? That Ger Shenidgar Kekoton Shenolad Dami? Some of the Meforshim understand that it comes from Har Sinai. That at Har Sinai, when the Torah was given, how do you know that there were people that were married to each other, that now the Torah is given, the Torah is saying you're not allowed to be married to each other? Obvious example, although they were not at Sinai, Amram was married to his aunt, Yocheved. That is not a relationship that you are permitted to have according to the Torah once you're Jewish. Now, how he was able to do that when he was non-Jewish or pre-Jewish, I'm not getting into now. So how did people manage to stay connected with everybody? It doesn't say anywhere everyone had to divorce and or split up and marry new people. It must be, I think it's the Chasam Sofer that says this, that when after Sinai, everybody was born fresh. And therefore nobody was related to each other at all. Which question, did they have to remarry? Okay, I'm not getting into that now. But the ultimate implication of that, look in the Shulchan Aruch, number 4. Din Torah, according to the strict letter of the law, Shemutel Agesha Yisra'imai, a ger could even marry his mother. Let's say they all converted together. George and Jessica and Patrick and Christine. Okay? All converted. They all become Jewish. None of them are related to each other. According to the Din Torah, the brother can marry the sister, the mother can marry the son, the father can marry the daughter. Everyone can marry each other. Or a chayse me'im, or he can marry his sister. They're not related. Shinid Gairu, because they're all converts. Ah, they're genetically related. That doesn't halachically make the difference. By the way, incest and the prohibitions are not always genetic anyway. You can't marry a brother-in-law, you can't marry a father-in-law, you can't marry a daughter-in-law. These are not genetic relations, but they're still prohibited as incestuous relationships. Aval, he says, the Chachamim Asru Davazeh, the rabbi said, no, we're not going to have people marrying their prior sisters, mothers, and brothers. Why? Kedusha lo yamru, we don't want people to say, banu mikedusha chamru li kedusha kala. We came from a higher level when we were non-Jews. Ah, when we were non-Jews, there were laws of incest. But now we're Jews, it's like everything is, kol mutar. Now, you know and I know that it's because they're not really related, but it doesn't smell good, and it's not healthy, and therefore we don't allow it. Okay, fine. Step brothers and sisters is a different question, which is not the issue here, but these are full genetic. But here you see that people who are genetically related without any question are not necessarily halachically related. So don't assume that genes is the answer. Okay, where are we going to find sources on surrogacy? Chazal had never performed surrogate operations. They didn't know, as far as we're aware, about the possibility of surrogate operations. So whereas there are many questions that are very modern and contemporary in medical ethics, which are also old questions, for example, if we were to have a discussion about abortion, abortion is a very relevant modern topic, but it's also an ancient topic. I fully expect and indeed find that the Torah and the Talmud discuss abortion, because people have been debating abortion as long as they've been getting pregnant, which is forever. Even cosmetic surgery, we saw that there were, you know, is an ancient reality, even though it's not something that obviously was done on the same level as it is today. Even gender reassignment operations, which you thought, well, people, how long have been people having sex change operations? It's the mod. The answer is the Ibn Ezra discusses a case of a man who becomes a woman, has an operation, and then has a relationship with a man. Is he called a man? Is he called a woman? The Ibn Ezra is 1,000 years ago. So some things sound new but are also old. But surrogacy, surely nobody envisaged surrogacy back in the day. We'll see. So let's start with some sources. Are we too warm or are we just nice? Are we okay? Okay, good, fine. I would like to check at some point. You can open the windows if you like. That's fine as well. So let's have a look. Rachel and Leah. Rachel and Leah. So we're going to start with some Agadic sources, and then we're going to see whether they are legitimate sources. Let's look at Rachel and number 5. Va'acha yaldabat. After that, he's talking about Leah. She gave birth to a daughter. Vatikra et shma Dina. She called her Dina. Okay, now there's a few strange things in that posik that at first sight you don't see, but then you think about it and you think that's strange. First of all, va'acha. After. After what? It just says, and after she gave birth. Okay, so after what? Yalda, she didn't get pregnant? She just gave birth? Usually it says she became pregnant, she gave birth. She just gave birth. There's no pregnancy apparently. Okay, this is not a bombshell question. Maybe you just didn't mention she got pregnant, because most people who gave birth get pregnant. And then she calls her Dina. Well, that's also strange, because whenever Leah gives a name to a child, there's a reason given in the Pasuk for the name. Reuven, Shimon, Levi, Yehuda, it always comes with a reason. I'm going to call him Reuven because the Mazmur will see me, Mazmur will hear me, Mazmur will go with me, etc. Dina, just justice. Why would you call a kid justice? So the Gemara in Brachas picks up on this, and Agadat in Brachas, number 6. Mai va'achar, what does it mean after? After what? I'm a Rav, so Rav says, la'achar shidana le'a din ba'atzma. Dina because of a din. She made a din on herself. A judgment, and she said, "Va'amra shnei masal shvatim asidim letzeis miYaakov." The Yaakov is going to have 12 tribes. Shisha yatz umimeni. I've already had 6: Reuven, Shimon, Levi, Yehuda, Yisachar, Zebulun. Okay, the arba min hashvachos. The maidservants have already had 4: Dan, Naphtali, Gad, Asher. 2 more to go. The Hari Asara, we're 10 down. 2 to go. Im ze zachar. If I'm having a child who is a boy, she's pregnant again, right? She's having another boy. Then lotehei achosi Rachel. Then my sister can maximum have ka'achas. She'll be even less than achas ashvachot. She's only 1 tribe left. I'm going to have tribe number 11. There's only 1. She's going to be less than the maidservants. I don't want that. I don't want to have a boy. Miyad, says the Gemara, nefcha lebat. The embryo inside her was immediately turned into a girl. And vice versa. The other way around, the embryo inside Rachel, assuming there wasn't, well, it doesn't actually say that the embryo was yet inside Rachel, but if there was an embryo inside Rachel, which is our understanding, it was turned from a girl into a boy. Okay? Shneemar, that's why it says, V'tikra Shman Dina. Dina, she has a little girl, she says, that's what I daven for. Now, that, on the surface, is nothing to do with surrogacy. This is someone with a child inside them, and she says, I don't want the gender to be, you know, that gender, I want to switch it. Which is interesting, because the Mishnah in Brachas, of course, says in the last chapter, if somebody davens when their wife is pregnant, I hope it's a boy, that is a tefillat shav. That is a wasted tefillah. It is what it is. You can daven before a person gets pregnant, I hope they get pregnant and have a boy, but once the baby's, once the embryo's there, what are you davening for? So what's going on here? So it is actually quite interesting, just medically, that even though the chromosomal XX or XY nature of the child is fixed at conception, the actual anatomical gender of the child depends on the release of hormones during the early stages of pregnancy. There are, it's quite rare, but I put in the footnotes here, there are certain syndromes where a young woman who assumes she's a young woman and anatomically looks like a young woman is actually an XY. And what happened is she has a male chromosomal makeup, and early in the pregnancy, when she was a fetus, there was, even before she was an embryo, there wasn't the release of testosterone which is needed in order to start the production of the male anatomy. Which because before, up to around 6 or 7 weeks, females and males have identical embryological anatomy, and then, depending on the hormones, things start to turn into what they turn into. So there can indeed be a man who actually is XX, or a woman who is actually XY. I'm not saying that's what's going on here. But it is, if you follow this through, this midrash, it is interesting to speculate and to think, okay, so Yosef is a boy who used to be a girl, and Dina is a girl who used to be a boy. Does that explain or inform us in any way on the way that they go on to live their lives? And actually, there is a parshanut that you could bring out from that about the nature of Yosef and the way he's focused on his looks, and the nature of Dino, who's always going out looking for action. And so I'm not saying that it's definitive, but there is what to say on that. However, for our purposes, it doesn't help us. It's not surrogacy. This is embryo gender change. Number seven, this might be, because the Targum Yonason brings this midrash in another form. It says as follows. The Targum Yonason, as I'm sure you're aware, is quite midrashic. It's not just a translation, it's a midrashic commentary. Umimbasa Kedain, after this, Yalid Brash, she had a little girl, Vakarat Shema Dina, she called her Dina, Arum, because, Amra, she said, Din hum min kadam Hashem, dihoi mini pagat shvataya, I want to have half of the tribes, but I'm min Rachel, and from Rachel, my sister, you have contrained shvatim, she should have two. At least two. Same as the idea. It looks like the maid servants have had. God listened to the saluta de Leah, to the prayers of Leah. Now, different answer. He switched the embryos. There was a switch, not a gender change. The Hava Yahiv Yosef the Rachel, and he put Yosef into the womb of Rachel. The Dina the Leah, and he put Dina into the womb of Leah. Wow, that's interesting, because that sounds more like surrogacy. You've got embryos switching from one womb to another womb. Not quite like surrogacy, because we don't take an embryo out of a womb and put it in another womb. We don't know how to do that yet. We might do in 20 years from now. We take it from a lab and put it in a womb. But that certainly sounds more interesting. And if you were to take this source at face value, which we'll see in a minute we're not going to, what does this indicate? That the genetic mother's the mother or the birth mother? The birth mother. If I go out in the streets and say, who was Yosef's mother? Everyone's going to say Rachel. No one's going to say, well, Leah, switch. No one's going to say that. They're going to say Rachel is the mother of Yosef. Dina is the mother of Leah. Leah is the mother of Dina, excuse me. It's the birth mother. What do I care where you started? I care where you finished as an embryo. And therefore, it sounds like the birth mother. Fine. Not so simple. There's another pasuk, number 8. The Torah says here later on, the children of Shimon. Ubnei Shimon Yimuel v'Yamin v'Ohad v'Yachin v'Tzochar v'Shaul ben Hakna'anit. He had a child, a little boy, Shimon, the tribe Shimon, called Shaul. By the way, interesting, that's a name that comes later as well. Ben Hakna'anit, the daughter of the Canaanite. Who's the Canaanite? Shaul had a Canaanite wife. We didn't hear. Shimon had a Canaanite wife. We never heard of this. Look at number 9, over the page, Rashi. Ben Hakna'anit. Ben Dina. Oh, this is the child of Dina. Why is she called a Knanit? Shenib Alal Knani, because tragically she was captured, she was kidnapped and raped by the Knanim. This is a reference to that episode in her life. Kesheharku, and Rashi says, Kesheharku et Shem, when Shimon and Levi killed Shem, Lohaya Dina Rotzelatset, she wouldn't leave. Interesting, this is fascinating midrash. She wouldn't leave with them. She says, I'm not leaving the Plishtim until Ashe Nishma, until Shimon swore to her, Nishbala Shimon Sheyis Ena, that he would marry her. Shimon swore that he would marry her. Because she's saying, look, the reason I'm in this predicament is because who's going to marry me? That was the problem, of course, that like a son will bring the wife in the ancient world into his family. But the danger was a daughter. What's a daughter? A daughter going to leave? That's why it says, the Midrash says, Avram was blessed with everything. He was blessed without the headache that he didn't have a daughter. If he'd have had a daughter, who's the daughter going to marry? Because Yitzchak, he can bring someone. He's very makpid, this week's Parsha. Don't take Yitzchak there. Bring the girl here. But if he has a daughter, she's going to end up marrying a non-Jew. That is, where else can that go? So Dina says, so I'm not going to find anyone to marry, so I want you, Shimon, to marry me. Okay, Shkoyach. So that's Dina. Shimon married Dina and had this child who's Shaul ben Achnani. Now, of course, you have a problem with Shimon marrying Dina, right? Shimon and Dina are full genetic relations. Father and mother. Son of Yaakov, son of Leah. Daughter of Yaakov, daughter of Leah. Look at the Torah number 10. Tema, says the Torah. Eich nasa Shimon achosa. How could Shimon marry his sister Minaav on the father's side? And on the mother's side. Ulefia midrash atishapi. But if you know the midrash, then it works very well. She'ika herayin shel Dina haya bebeten Rachel. Dina's not really the child of Leah, is she? She's really the child of Rachel. And as the and on the father's side, we're not interested, because before Matan Torah, the father's side is far less relevant. As long as she's not on the mother's side, then that's okay. So here you see the Torah is saying, we do actually go back to the original gestation and say that Dina is really the daughter of Rachel. Well, at least when it serves us to say that. So maybe it's not so clear. We'll see in a minute, none of this is going to help us at all. It's interesting, but it's not going to help us at all. Also Esther. Esther, it says she had no father and mother. This quickly, the Gemara in Megillah says, number 12, Ki ein la av ve'em, she has no father and mother. So he says, why do we need to see this? He says, Ubamoisa via ve'ima. It says when her father and mother had died already. So why are you telling me she has no father and mother? I know. He says her father and mother died and Mordechai adopted her. So Amar of Acha, the Gemara says, no. Ivrita, when the mother was pregnant, Mesavia, her father sadly died. Yalda time, when the mother was in the process of giving birth, Mesaima, her mother died as well. Says Rashi, Ukashi Yaldata, Amar Ima Mesa, sorry, Velo Nirit Likot Aim. She was never called a mother. That's what it means, Esther had no mother. Because her mother died in childbirth, she never had a mother. So again, take that at face value. Why didn't she have a mother during pregnancy? That wasn't a mother? Apparently not. It sounds, leaving aside the little wrinkle with Shimon and Dina, it sounds like the birth mother is the mother. Yeah? Rachel and Leah switch the babies. Dina's the daughter of Leah. Birth mother. Esther has no mother, because what happened during pregnancy doesn't count, because we're only interested in the birth mother. Now, in the case that I referred to in London, they used a non-Jewish birth mother. We'll get to why they picked that in a minute. So if they take the egg and the sperm of a Jewish couple and implant them into a non-Jewish birth mother, according to these sources, the assumption will be the baby is born not Jewish. Can a baby be converted? Of course it can. And that is what they did at the time in London. Lord Jacobovitz ruled that at least there's a question that the baby goes after the surrogate mother, and therefore the babies, it was assumed that the babies would be converted and they can be Jewish. But in that particular case, will the babies be Kohanim? You can't convert to be a Kohen. You can only convert to be a Yisrael. So if you're going to say that the mother is the birth mother decides the halachic connection, so then the children will be born non-Jewish and they cannot be Kohenim. They have to convert, etc. However, you're all thinking to yourselves, well, this is all a gadita. We had a shir some years ago on whether you can use a gadita for halachic issues, and the general answer is no. You're coming to a base and saying, is it my child or her child? You're going to start talking about Rachel and Leah and Dina and Yosef. Like, what is that? Look in number 13. Talmud Yerushalmi. Rabbi Zeru B'Shem Shmuel said the following. Ein Moirin. You're not allowed to pass an halacha. Loimina halachas. No, that sounds a bit strange. You can't pass an halacha from halacha. Halachas here means halacha l'moshe mi-Sinai. Learning out new cases from a chidush, which is a law from Sinai, which is a chidush in itself, you can't necessarily learn from that to other places. V'loy mina agadas, you can't use a gadata to pass in halacha. V'loy mina tosfos, v'loy mina elamina talmud, you have to use the Gemara. It has to be in the Gemara. Can't use a gadata. And the Tosfos Yonzer says, achata shafti, I see now, Tosfos Yonzer on the Mishnah, ra'iti yasi she'ein lemeidim, ha'aleim loimim halachas mi midrash rabbas. You don't learn halacha from the midrash rabbah. So you cannot use the Midrashim as a basis to Paskan Halacha. And the Noda B'Yehuda, in a case which we discussed, remember the case of Esther And whether how Esther could marry Ahasuerus, remember Rav Ari Schwartz's tshuva on whether a woman who is a spy for the Mossad is allowed to have a relation, sexual relations with the head of the Iranian nuclear program in order to get information, in order to, you know, cause disruption to their program, but she's married, can she? And there was a suggestion that maybe that's allowed because Esther slept with Ahasuerus, even though she was married to Mordechai, and that was okay, apparently, because it was to save the Jewish people. We went through the whole tshuva. So the Nodi Yehuda was asked this question. The question came up because there was a case of a woman, if you remember the case, there was a group of people that were kidnapped by highwaymen back in the day in the 1700s, and the highwayman said, I'm going to rob you all and kill you all, and he really meant it. You could trust him on that one, okay? And one of the married women said, if I sleep with you, will you let us all go? And he said, yes, I'm a man of my word. And he did, and she did, and he did. And the question was then, did she do the right thing or the wrong thing? And can she now still be married to her husband? She'd saved like 25 lives, but through an act of adultery, is that okay? So they started bringing riots from Esther. So the Noni Yehuda says, number 15, HaMidrashim v'ha'agadas ikka kavanasam el ha'musa. Agadata is for Musa. V'al ha'ramazim, there are hints there. V'al ha'mashalim, and there are parables. Shebehem, parables shebehem, which are in them. V'hakol ikka hadat, it's all very important for religious life. Agadata is a critical. We learn so many important religious principles from Midrashim. Aval ein ikka kavanasam al piske halachas. But they're not there to pass an halacha from. We may not learn anything from the halacha, but Yasakov Satoshis Yonsev Sham. And I agree with the Tosfos Yonsev. However, Rabbi Kiva Eger said, not so quick. Rabbi Kiva Eger said in number 16, and Rabbi Avadi Yosef mirrors that in number 17. This was a bigger share that we had, and we talked about more sources. Yes, that's true when a midrash goes against an accepted halachic principle in Shas. Of course, we're not going to use midrashim. But what happens when the Shas doesn't talk about it? What happens when there's a black hole and we need to fill it with something? So there, maybe midrashim are relevant. And he suggests that we, and Rabbi Avadi says the same thing. Don't just write off midrashim as irrelevant. Maybe they can fill in where other things don't tell us what to do. And then there's a question, maybe a midrash in the Gemara is a higher status than the midrash in the Midrash Rabbah. That's another question which the Gaonim talk about. What is the difference in status between the Agadic material in our Gemara and the Agadic material which never made it into the Gemara? Okay, so we can talk about that ad infinitum almost, but we're not going to because we need to keep focused on the question at hand. But let's assume that Midrashim will not get us the whole way. Are there any other sources? Luckily for us, there are halachic sources. Look at number 19, Yibum. Won't be long now before Dafyomi, if anyone's into Dafyomi, is back into Yavamas again. Prepare yourself, steel yourself now. So get ready for the big day. Coming, I think, in March. Look at number 19. Tashma, says the Gemara. You know how Yibum works. Yibum works as follows. Man marries woman. Man dies without having children. Man has brother. She, if her deceased husband has a brother, that's going to be fun. Maybe we'll have to close the window again. If the deceased husband has a brother, she has to deal with the brother situation. Either she marries him, that's called Yibum, or she divorces from him, that's called Chalitza. Whether we do this today, how we do it, I'm not getting into. But she has to deal with the brother. She can't ignore it. If her dead husband has a brother, got to deal with that before she marries someone else. Okay. So now the Gemara gives a few cases. Whether he's married or not, because in theory he could marry more than one wife, and we don't do that anymore, but not for now. Number 19, Tashma, Gemara. This is real halacha, nothing midrashic here. Shnei achim te'umim geirim. We have two little... Yes, sir?
The chiyuv is on the woman or the brother?
The chiyuv is on the brother, but the mother has an isur. She is prohibited from marrying someone else until it's dealt with. The mitzvah is incumbent on the brother to deal with it, but she has the consequences until it's dealt with. Okay? Now, two achim, two brothers, who are twins, who are geirim. Okay, so let's get the case very clear. Christine has two little boys, Roger and Patrick. And she says to them, they're five-year-old twins. She says, Roger and Patrick, we're all going to become Jewish. It's going to be amazing. They all go to the mikveh, they have the bris milah, they do everything, and now he's called Reuven and he's called Pinchas, and they're all one happy Jewish family, okay? What's the scenario? Fast forward 20 years, the little boys grow up, one of them gets married, dies without children. Does his widow have to deal with the Yibam situation, yes or no? And the answer is? Does her dead husband have a brother, yes or no? No, because they converted, and the first thing we learned today is if you convert, you're like a newborn child. So dead husband does not have a halachic brother. That's a genetic brother, but who cares? Okay, so the Gemara says, loy chaltzim v'loy mi'admin. There's no chalitza, there's no yibum. Then chayvim v'shomesh yisach, and they're not even brothers-in-law, she could marry him. He's not a brother-in-law, nothing. Fine. But here's the next case. Roger and Patrick weren't five-year-olds. Roger and Patrick were embryos, fetuses, waiting to come out. Haita horatan shelo b'kedusha. What if she conceived them when she was non-Jewish, Christine? The leidasan b'kedusha, but she gave birth to them when she was converted, chanaleya. What's the story? Again, what's the scenario? This woman now, Christine, has not got five-year-olds in this scenario. The scenario is she's got, you know, twins. She's 9 months pregnant. She writes on her, you know, her tummy, Roger and Patrick. She talks to them, and one night she says to them, Roger and Patrick, we're all going to become Jewish tomorrow. She goes to the mikveh. They come out. We'll see in a minute whether a pregnant woman can convert her children inside her. But it works. She rubs off Roger and Patrick. She writes Reuven and Pinchas. We're all Jewish now. A week later, she goes to the hospital, has the babies. Fast forward 25 years, one of them gets married and dies without children. Is there or is there not a brother relationship? That's a halachic question. That could be happening at a mikveh near you. So there already, it could go in different directions. On the one hand, these are two little boys born from a Jewish mother. Nachon? They're born from a Jewish mother. Chanaleh, she's not Christine anymore. On the other hand, they were conceived by a non-Jewish mother, Christine, and they were converted, so they are converts who are brothers. So if they're converts, maybe they start from scratch, and they're not brothers. And really, what the Gemara is asking here, potentially, is who is the real mother of these children? Is it Christine, the conception mother, genetic mother, or is it Chanaleh, the birth mother? These are children with two different mothers. Same human being, but two different halachic mothers. Christine pre-conversion and Chanaleah post-conversion. So in many ways, this is as close as we're going to get to a Gemara that says, if a baby has two mothers, one is the conception, one is the birth, which is the real mother? And the Gemara says, lo chaltzim v'lo mi'admin, technically they're not into Yibam because they don't share a father, which is not for now. Aval chayavim mishomesh yisach, but they're brothers. They're brothers. And you can't marry a brother-in-law. Why are they chayavim? Says number 20, Rashi. The chayavim karis, if she were to marry the brother of her husband when he died. Mishumei shisach minayin, because they're brothers on the mother's side. Look at Rashi. Shehari hiki Yisraeli sheyal davar. She's like any other Jewish woman that gave birth to children. Now, many poskim jumped on this source. Rav Zalman Chenya Goldberg. And other people, I put them in the footnotes and said, this is a pretty convincing halachic, not a gadic source, that the halachic mother is the birth mother. Because in this case, we're not interested in Christine. We don't consider them converts. We consider them born from a Jewish mother, Chanaleah, Vazel. Interesting. Others said, not so straightforward. Rabbi Yaakov Ariel said, look, you can't ignore genetics completely. If the genetic mother is someone else, you're going to say that's not relevant. It's such an impact on the child. But this, for many people, convinced them, including the case that I was talking about in London, the birth mother is relevant, and therefore if the birth mother is not Jewish, the children have to be converted. So you can ask yourself the question, so if everything goes with the birth mother, why didn't they just pick a Jewish surrogate? Because if you pick a Jewish surrogate, then the babies are for sure Jewish. It doesn't matter who the mother is. The genetic mother's Jewish, and the birth mother's Jewish. For sure you have Jewish children. The problem is that if you go with the birth mother answer, and this surrogate mother acts as a surrogate for multiple families over the course of years, if they're all her halachic children as the birth mother, then they'll all be brothers and sisters. And we don't want that because they don't know each other. And they're going to grow up and go to university and someone's going to meet, you know, and stranger things have happened. I'm not going to it now because I don't have time, but a strange thing like that almost happened in my own family 60 years ago, where someone ended up going out with someone who turned out to be their halachic brother, who'd been adopted, and they never knew, and could have been disastrous. But, you know, so stranger things have happened. It didn't happen like that in the end. So that's also a birth mother indicator, interestingly. But there are other sources as well. For example, in number 21, I'm going to do this quite quickly. The Gemara here says very clearly that if a woman, like we just saw, if a woman goes to the mikveh to convert with babies inside her, then the babies, that works for the baby as well. That conversion works for the baby as well. And the Gemara says, like, how? Isn't there a chatzitza? But if you go to the mikveh with something on top of your skin, then it'll stop it from the mikveh from working. Ah, but maybe it's not makpid, because if you have ruba ve'eino makpid, it works on a Torah level. I'm not getting into all of the, it'll take us beyond what we can do in today's class. But the Gemara actually concludes here that it is not chotzetz. The pregnancy does not stop the mikveh from working for the babies. Look at the last couple of lines in this Gemara. Shani uber, because a pregnancy, an embryo is different. Dahainu rabisi, because it's in its natural environment. It grows there. This conversion works for that baby. And the some of the Mephoshim say there, Shehem guf echad. They're one body, they're one thing. The mother and baby are one thing. And if you just peep over the page onto top of page 6, there is a principle we see in Gittin and many places, Uber Yerech Imohu. An Uber is an organ of the mother. It's like a limb of the mother. The baby, the fetus, is like a limb of the mother. Now, if we're going to say that the fetus is the limb of a mother, you are not the mother of one of your limbs. I'm not the mother, father of my arm, the father of my tummy, the father of my leg. My arm is me. So if you're going to say that a mother and a fetus are one person, then that implies that, again, that motherhood won't start until they separate. When they separate, we can talk about who's your mother. But when you're part of the body of that person, she's not the mother of her own body. She is her own body. So again, that leads more, again, Poskim to suggest, it could be that it's the birth mother which is the real indicator of motherhood, rather than the others. However, rather than genetics. However, it's again never so straightforward. There are a number of discussions in the Poskim as to, you know, when actually do these babies become Jewish? Let's take this case of forget the twins, a regular mother with a regular one child inside her, son is born and has a bris milah on the 8th day. Does he have a bris milah because he's just a standard Jewish baby? Therefore, he needs a bris milah on the 8th day. Meaning, whatever he converted inside is history. She's a Jewish woman. She had a Jewish baby. He has a bris on the 8th day. Shalom on Israel. That's what Tosfos say. The Ramban says, no, this baby is actually a convert. The bris milah he has on the 8th day is the conversion bris milah. Not just the halachic, you're a Jewish baby bris milah. It comes in the wrong order. Normally we do milah first and then go to the mikveh. And this embryo went to the mikveh and later had it. Okay, so the Ramban says, but yeah, it's okay in the other direction as well. So according to the Ramban, this embryo had an independent entity and converted in its own right and is not Jewish when it's born. Needs conversion. If that's the case, then that sounds more like it existed independently of its mother, and maybe she was the mother already from conception. You can see why it's already getting a little bit complicated. Yeah? I'm about to make it even more complicated, I'm sorry. Okay? Source number 23. There are a number of sources that indicate, or at least point to the possibility that genetics is the key. Genetics is the key, and we're not interested in birth mother. Look at number 23. Tan Rabbanan. Shalosh Shutvim Yesh Ba'adam. There are three partners to a person. HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the Aviv, the Imoy. It's quite a famous Gemara. Hashem, the mother and the father. Aviv Mazriya Haloivin, the father gives the white material for the baby. Shimemenu Atzamas, that makes the bones, the gidim and the sinews, the tziporanim and the nails. The moich and the brain matter, shebarosh inside the head. The loivin shebaayin, and the white in the eye. Imoi Mazrat Oidim, the mother gives the red. Don't forget, back in the day, they didn't know of the existence of the ovum, as far as we're aware. They didn't know that. They knew that there was sperm that were donated by the father, but the mother is basically the blood. It's the placenta. That they knew. They didn't know about genes, as far as we're aware, and they didn't know about the ovum that was part of the fertilization. So the mother gives all the red stuff. Shemimenu, or it makes the skin, vabasar on the flesh, vasar on the hair, v'shchor b'shechor sheba'ayim, and the pupil, black in the eye. And what does the Kodesh Baruch Hu contribute? Kodesh Baruch Hu noisim ba'ruach, the neshama. Hashem gives the ruach and the neshama, klaster panim, the face, and the individuality of the person, ri'iya sa'ayin, and the sense of sight, shmir sa'ayin, of hearing, dibu per of speech, holak reglaim, of movement, ubina, v'seichol. Okay? People who have seichel, which are not everybody, they get that from our Kodesh Baruch. Okay, fine. So if that's the case, we're going back to genetics here. She gives this, he gives that, Hashem gives that. And it sounds, Rav Goren, as far as I can recall, yeah, Rav Goren I put here, says this seems very clear, that everybody's status as mom and dad is fixed on conception. This all happens at the moment of conception. And he wanted to go very much with the genetics as the decider on these issues. Most remarkably of all, and this is the source I think that you'll remember when you go home today, I mean, maybe you remember all of them, I don't want to underestimate your memories, but this is the source which is my favorite on the sheet. The Gemara debates Bechor. What's Bechor? So you're a farmer, you're a Jewish farmer, and you have a kosher animal, a cow, a sheep, a ewe, let's say, it's a female. And they are pregnant with a firstborn male. Firstborn male kosher animal. Status is Bechor. Now, back in the day, Bechor was a big simcha, right? Who does the Bechor belong to? The Kohen. You give the Bechor to a Kohen, and if it's got no blemishes, he brings it as a Korban. It's a big party. It's amazing. Everyone loves a Bechor. Goes to the Kohen, we can do a mitzvah. Today, a Bechor is a nightmare. Who am I going to give a Bechor to? The Kohen can't take the Bechor now. Can't bring it as a Korban. But I have all the halachas. I can't work it. I can't shear it. I can't eat it. I can't kill it. It's like a wild wild chaya running around my farm. Nobody wants a Bechor. It's a headache. So what do you do? Lamaisa, today, what do Jewish farmers do? Either they daven it should be a girl, or more practically, they enter into a partnership with a non-Jewish owner, and the non-Jewish owner then has a part ownership of whatever the embryo is, and then it's not a Bechor anymore. Fine. Here comes a clever Talmudic farmer back in the day. It says like this. Mm-hmm. My animal, let's call it a cow, let's call it Betsy. Betsy is pregnant with a little male calf. And it's going to be a Bechor. It's a first one. But I can actually minimize my problems here. Look at number 24. Says the Gemara. Chulim. Gemara in Chulim. Hidbik shnei rachamim. He takes two wombs and he puts them together. What does this farmer do? He takes Daisy the cow. Was it Betsy before? Betsy the cow. Takes Betsy the cow and he brings Daisy the cow. Daisy's never had any child. So Daisy's ready for number one. And he backs them up together so that they're back-to-back, these two cows. What happens? The yatsam is there, and the embryo comes out of Betsy. This embryo is a Bechor, like it or not. He comes out of Betsy, the nichnas lezeh, and goes into Daisy. And then comes out of Daisy again. Why is he doing this? He's doing this to forgive my mixed metaphors, to kill two birds with one stone. He's saying, let this Bechor be a Bechor for two of my cows. And then Daisy's yotze as well. Daisy's had a Bechor. She shared with Betsy. Does it work? Mahu. Halachically. Does it work? Now, practically, it doesn't work. Please don't try this with your pets. Or your friends. You'll end up in jail or hospital or both. Okay? Doesn't work. And believe me, they knew full well. They knew more about cows than I'll ever know. They knew it doesn't work. We'll come to that in a minute. But does it halakhically work? Meaning, does this firstborn qualify as the firstborn of both Daisy and of Betsy? Let's have a look. Didei Pata, says the Gemara, it works for the first cow, Betsy, for sure. Betsy, don't forget, is the cow that carried the little calf and then gave birth to it before it popped into Daisy for a couple of minutes. It works for her. The lav didei, but for the new cow, for Daisy, lo pata, it didn't work for her. Or Dilma, or maybe the lav didei nami pata, or maybe it did work for her. Meaning the suffix, the question is on the Daisy, the second cow. Think about this for a second. Betsy is a conception mother and a birth mother. Daisy is only a birth mother. And we're asking, maybe it doesn't work if you're only a birth mother. That doesn't count as your baby. Says the Gemara Teku, I don't know. We don't know. We don't Paskin as a Sophic. We don't know. Tosfos in Ksubas and other places has a list. Tosfos were in the Middle Ages, right? In the 12th, 13th century. They have a list of their favorite, all-time favorite strange Gemaras. Someone, a weasel goes in the womb and comes out again. You know, there's all the weird. And this is on the list. One of the list there is if you use a live animal for the lid of a coffin, you know, all strange things. Or maybe it's the gravestone. There's a discussion there. So Tosfos says, come on. Why would the rabbis have nothing better to do than to ask questions about cases which could never happen? Why would they even debate this? And Tosfos says, you know something we don't know? Maybe it's for the schus of Talmud Torah. You get schar for learning. It's Talmud Torah. Because, says Tosfos, nobody can take an embryo from one mother and implant it into another one. That's not something that we can do. So why would Chazal discuss the halachic merits and consequences of such an act? Now, that is something we can do. This is now a significant source. It needed 800 years for the technology to catch up to the Gemara, but now Tosfos would have an answer, potentially. Maybe. Maybe not. Or you're going to turn around to me and say, oh, come on. This is not talking about surrogacy. This is talking about Bechor. And we don't take things out of one womb and put... Are you going to say this is relevant or not relevant? A couple of last things. Not last. We've got 5 minutes to go. We've got a lot of important things to say. Go to page 7. There is a good possibility that actually there are two mothers. Imagine the joys of having two Jewish mothers. Or even a Jewish mother and a non-Jewish mother. Which is interesting. What is the case if you have two mothers? Why would you have two mothers? Because the Gemara, I'll tell you the case outside, the Gemara discusses all sorts of interesting scenarios. First of all, with Sfiras HaOmer. You know how Omer, it's not Sfiras HaOmer, the bringing the Korban Omer. You know how it works. Wheat that is growing before the Omer is exempted, you're allowed to eat that, it becomes Yasham once you the 16th of Nisan comes. Now, can't we have a whole share on this? But wheat which only grows afterwards, which is planted afterwards, has to wait for the next year in Nisan. So what, says the Gemara, if I have wheat growing happily through February and March, but before the Omer I uproot it, and 2 days later after the Omer I plant it again. And now some of that wheat is post, and some of it is pre. Do we consider that to be the old crop, which is okay now, or the new crop, which has to wait for next Pesach? Which do we go like? And the Gemara says, maybe that's the same as the following. Let's say it's like a tree which has a branch, which is orla, a little lemon growing on a tree, which is 1 year old. Can't eat that lemon. It's orla, first 3 years. So I take off that branch, and I graft it into, these are things they could do then, I graft it into an old tree, which is 10 years old. And now the lemon continues to grow. What is that lemon? Who is its mummy? Is its mummy the young tree that it came from, or the old tree that it ended up on? And there the Gemara says, maybe both. We're choshish for both. It's got two mothers. So many poskim on a lemaisa basis, number 26, here Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach is famously quoted as saying that he found a source in the voluminous rabbinic literature for every question that was posed to him, including all medical and technological advances, barring one, namely the question of determining motherhood in a surrogacy case. Therefore, Rav Auerbach stated that we must be tricked in both directions. When the egg donor is not Jewish, the child requires conversion. When the gestational carrier is not Jewish, the child requires conversion. And this is, in many ways, how many posts can go today. Both of them may indeed be the mothers. Which, of course, is interesting. If you have a Jewish mother and a non-Jewish mother, are you Jewish? Are you Jewish? Are you half-Jewish? How does that work? And I brought you, if you just flip over the page, I brought you a bunch of different... A list of different poskim who in the past have said different things. Now, health warning. People who passed on this 30 years ago, who did not know the up-to-date medical analysis today, may or may not have changed their psak. I can't guarantee to you that people, that Rabbi Eliashiv was passing the same way today as he passed on this 10 years ago, because he's no longer alive. But this is basically what most people said. I brought you the sources. Some of the poskim said it's birth. Some of the poskim said it's genetics. Some of the poskim said it's both. And that will impact on whether you want to have a Jewish or a non-Jewish surrogate. Like I said to you before, if you think that birth is the determinant, you will probably want to go for a non-Jewish surrogate. If you feel that it's genetics, then you'll go for a Jewish. Why would you mix in a whole non-Jewish element to it for no benefit at all? So this is a question which remains a question. I just brought you at the end, I'd like you to look at this briefly, on pages 9 and 10. I brought you a lengthy excerpt from a... piece by Rav Ezra Bick. Rav Ezra Bick, who lives in Gush Etzion, in Alon Shvut, he wrote in Tradition, and he suggests the following. You can read this in your own time, but I'll summarize what he says. He says, look, this is great, and I appreciate where the poskim are coming from, and we always try and find a source in the Talmud for everything we're doing. But let's face it, he said. At the end of the day, this is a question which there really is no source that directly deals with it. What do we do when there are questions that come up where even though the Talmud is brilliant and we can talk about Bechor and amazing things like that, there's no real source for this. Where do we look? We don't have anywhere else to look. You can't just pick a random midrash. We all agree on that. You can't just pick a random midrash and say, we'll base a whole halachic topic on that. But he says the following, and he's a brisker in terms of the way he learns. He says, look, we spend all of this time working out deeper and deeper levels of analysis as to what's really going on in the Gemara. Meaning, what's a classic brisker hakira? You know, the Gemara says X practically in one place and Y in another place. What is the machlokas? How do these two things go together? So you look for ever deeper, more abstract, fundamental principles that are going on there. And then you start to realize, there are really two elements. There are two aspects to this. There's this abstract aspect and there's this abstract. And that's why the Gemara is just the tip of an iceberg, which reflects two different places, but there's an underlying deeper and more fundamental concept going on. And you keep going deeper and deeper. Now, in yeshiva, you do this for lomdas. But says Rav Bik, if this is true, what we're doing here in yeshiva, this is real, then this could work for halacha as well. Meaning maybe where we need to go to get halachic answers for new questions is we need to plumb the depths of halachic abstract thought and get to the principles which underpin it. And once we, thank you very much. And once we do that, maybe those principles that we've now identified will give us new solutions where the Talmud didn't apply them practically, but they're real. We're not just pulling them out of thin air. We're not just thinking, I think it's this, intuitively. We can all intuit anything we like. It just becomes random. And we're not just picking agaditas like because they sound cool and look good. We're actually going to something much more fundamental and trying to create new halachic practical psak out of deeper halachic principled thought, which is actually very interesting and I think quite deep and maybe one of the ways forward on this. Although I've not seen anyone else, I've not looked that hard, but I've not seen anyone else pick up on Rav Bik. This was already in tradition 30 years ago, nearly. So I assume that the people have talked about that more. Maybe I'll do some more research. But that might be the direction we go in. But one thing is for sure, surrogacy is here and with us. And hundreds and thousands and thousands and thousands of women are now having surrogate babies and being surrogate mothers. And it's an incredible mitzvah to do that, to help a family have a child. That's amazing. Most poskim say that a married woman shouldn't be a surrogate mother because of all the shilas involved. Although if you look on the Nishmat website, I checked out their advice. They basically say, it's complicated. We're going to ask a rabbi. We're not going to tell you anything on this. But this is now a very real issue. And Baruch Hashem, surrogacy has enabled us to create many, many Jewish families. But the jury is still out. Let's have a look and see what people say as time goes on and where they get the answer to these questions from. So I hope you enjoyed that roller coaster ride through surrogacy. Next week we're going down to something much more down to earth, I think, but I won't promise what it is yet because I'm not sure I'll have the time to prepare it. Because I'm going to America in a couple